Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI appeals for greater respect for life. Cardinal Walter Kasper speaks out at the opening of a three-day international symposium organised to discuss the future of the ecumenical movement. Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright talks of his recent travels to Nigeria, where he visited a very particular monastery and its renowned Centre for Herbalistic Medicine. And film critic Peter Malone tells us what he thinks about the latest Hollywood film that is breaking all box office records to date. Pope Benedict XVI appealed for greater respect for life this Sunday, saying no one is master of his own life, but all of us are called to preserve and respect life from the moment of conception until its natural end. Chris Altieri has this report.
Pope Benedict was speaking to the faithful gathered in St. Peter's Square for the traditional Angelus prayer this Sunday, which was also Respect Life Sunday in Italy, this year dedicated especially to the fight against poverty. The Holy Father renewed his appeal on the occasion for commitment to integral human development and reminded the faithful that man's true purpose is not financial success in this life, but eternal happiness in and with God.
E soprattutto ricorda che il fine dell'uomo non è il benessere.
This Sunday was the fifth in ordinary time, and the Holy Father also reflected on the theme of divine vocation.
The Gospel invites us, like the apostles, to put out into the deep, that is, to be brave and zealous in our following Jesus by being obedient to his will. Like St. Peter on the lake of Genesaret, we'll discover that fidelity to the Lord leads to a deeper relationship with God and opens us to his gifts. Let us overcome all fears and hesitation, that we may rediscover how much God longs to bless us. Upon each of you and your loved ones at home, I invoke God's abundant blessings.
Ahead of the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict also prayed for an increase in vocations to the priesthood. In this year of priests, he said, pray to the Lord of the harvest to send laborers into his fields, so that many might hear the Lord's call to follow him and, after necessary discernment, respond with generosity, not trusting in their own strength, but opening themselves to the action of his grace. Trusting to the Blessed Virgin all vocations, especially those to the priesthood and religious life, Pope Benedict asked Mary to stir in everyone the desire to say yes to the Lord with joy and full dedication. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks there to Chris Altieri for that report. An international symposium with the intriguing title of Harvesting the Fruits is taking place at the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity this week. The three-day meeting brings together over 30 leading theologians from the Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Methodist, and Reformed churches to discuss the future of the ecumenical movement. The symposium is expected to conclude with the publication of a joint text and the celebrations of Vespers in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls on Wednesday afternoon. In opening remarks to the participants on Monday, the President of the Council, Cardinal Walter Kasper, gave an overview of the extraordinary progress made over the past 40 years in overcoming the bitter divisions of previous centuries. He also suggested the drawing up of an ecumenical catechism and argued that previous Vatican documents, notably the 2000 Dominus Jesus, should have been presented in more ecumenically sensitive language. Philippa Hitchin talked to him about the goals of this important meeting.
Now we have 40 years of dialogue, the whole pile of documents, and we do not want that they become dusty in bookshelves, but that they are received in the living body of our churches. And so we made a summary in order to facilitate the reception process. And the second point is, now is a new generation coming up after 14 years. They have to take over the torch, and they should not start again from the scratch. We will show to him, well, we can achieve something by the dialogue, and we achieved a lot more than I thought before, and they should build up on this basis we have already reached. And for this reason, we did not only in a triumphalistic way say what we have achieved, but we identified also the open questions. And a question once identified is already half of the solution.
You talk indeed about many of the outstanding problems. You also talk about the crux of the ecumenical question. What goal are we working towards? Visible unity, yes, but what does this mean? You talk about unity and diversity.
Yes, it's the crux of the problem, because we have different ecclesiologies. And because we have different ecclesiologies, we have different theories about the goal of unity. And there is no neutral position. I can only explain the Catholic position, that's full communion, in full sharing in faith, in the sacraments, and also in apostolic ministry. But this can be done only by degrees and by steps. So we are already in a fundamental communion with the other churches coming out from the Reformation of the 16th century. And so the Church of Christ is already in an effective way present in them. There is no ecclesiological vacuum outside the Catholic Church, and the subsisted in them may not be understood in this wrong way, but the full presence is as we say, only in the Catholic Church. This does not mean that in the Catholic Church are no deficiencies. So ecumenical dialogue means sharing of gifts, exchange of gifts, and it's a learning process from all sides. And so it's a process not go back to the 16th century. It's impossible to go back in church history, but it's a process forward towards Christ. And if we are united in Christ, we'll be united also among ourselves.
You're stressing, therefore, that the Church of Christ also exists outside the boundaries of the Catholic Church. And yet, as you know, the debate around this term, subsisted in, continues to cause a lot of interest. Many people, as you know, would not see it that way. To them, ecumenism means a return to Rome.
Yes, it's true. There was a little of uneasiness in the last years and a lot of conflict also about this formula. But if we take it in the context of the Council, the formula has two meanings. First of all, a full realization of the Church of Christ into the Catholic Church. But there are elements, and it means important elements, also outside the Church. Both truths are to be seen, and Pope John Paul II said, to that degree, these elements are already present. The Church of Christ in an effective way is present also outside. And so it's a differentiated interpretation we have to give, and we do it in accordance with the encyclical letter of John Paul II, Ut Unum Sint. But of course, this will remain a crux. There are different understandings. That's the reason why we are divided, and now we have to discuss this point. Of course, yeah, our partners will explain how they understand it, and then we must come to a sharing and to a discussion. And it's a way to go together. There are not fixed standpoints, but we have to go on. We can also talk about the pilgrimage towards full communion.
Cardinal Casper, you also say that mistakes were made in the publication of the document Dominus Iesus. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that's a question of language all the time. It's a doctrinal language. Congregation for Doctrine of Faith uses normally. I could imagine a language which does not water down the doctrine, but is more acceptable, more accessible to the other churches. And this is, for me, the main lack. It's a Catholic doctrine which is expressed in this document, but it can be expressed in a different way. And especially, we should not always talk what the other do not have. That we should say what we have and what we have to give to the others, and what we that we expect also their gifts. And so I think it's more a dialogical style I would want in such documents.
You talk also about deficiencies within the Catholic Church and the need for gifts to be received from other churches. What do you understand mainly by this?
Well, first of all, we are a church to which belong also sinners. And we all are sinners, and this means deficiencies in the realization of the Church of Christ. And the second point is, by the division, there were also some aspects we have not lost, but a little bit forgotten and overshadowed. Especially, we have learned from the Protestant Church the importance of the Word of God. We received many things from their Bible studies. We can receive from the Anglican Communion about their understanding of the comprehensiveness of the Church, and of conciliarity or synodality. And so it's a mutual learning from both sides to reach to the fullness of Jesus Christ.
You also know that it's often said there are varying views within the Vatican itself on this ecumenical question.
Yeah, of course, we are human beings, and human beings have always different views. It's normal, it's not a weakness, it's a richness, and we are in discussion among others, but it's differences. These are differences on the basis of common Catholic faith, of course, but then we can have different options, different aspects, and this is the reason why I sent this document in the Italian translation to all superiors of the other dicasteries, and they were very hopeful. And also the Holy Father reacted in a very positive way. He quoted it even in his catechesis of Wednesday. And so I think this document helps also in the Roman Curia.
That was Cardinal Walter Kasper, President of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. One of the people I most enjoy speaking to, as I'm sure you've noticed, is Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright, whose voice is frequently part of this programme. Now, very often he's out of town, as he's involved in a series of initiatives that are focused on interreligious dialogue and Benedictine affairs. But when he is here in Rome, he lives at the Pontifical Beda College, where he's spiritual director and theology professor to the students there who are studying to become priests. During the Christmas holidays, he was invited to spend some time in Nigeria, where he visited St. Benedict's monastery at Iwu. I caught up with him upon his return and asked him to explain its whereabouts and tell me something about its history.
Iwu is in Edo State in the south middle, about an hour and a half north of Benin City. I had not visited the community before. It was founded some 30 years ago from a monastery in Ireland called Glenstall Abbey.
Now, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, so you may already know, but Abbot Timothy Wright is an expert on Christian-Muslim dialogue and the advisor on interreligious affairs to the Abbot Primate of the Order of St. Benedict.
And so I was interested to see it because of its possible links with the local Muslim community, an area which I'm investigating on behalf of the Abbot Primate. And I had a wonderful 3 weeks there. Community of about 35 monks coming from different parts of Nigeria, providing a very cheerful, prayerful, and in many ways inspiring few days. It was, of course, the Christmas season, and naturally it was a time of festivity. But it was also a time when I could meet the individual monks and talk about the life that they live and its relationship to Islam and to the wider Church of Nigeria.
All in all, Abbot Timothy remarked, a wonderful few days that included a couple of things that struck him more than others.
The first thing that struck me was that of its youth. It was vibrant, had many younger monks who were enthusiastic, prayerful. Many of them were studying. And as with many young monks, they were very welcoming and eager to talk. And then I was able to see a little bit around the monastery. And it's a monastery which is built in separate buildings on quite a large piece of land in the countryside. It has obviously a church and a big guest house. It has single-story buildings for the monks' cells, a separate block for the dining facilities, another for their common room and for their study rooms. In other words, it's a set of buildings separate from each other, and it doesn't have a square cloister as would be the traditional European model. And that allows, therefore, a sense of space within the monastic enclosure. And, of course, in that part of Nigeria, there's plenty of trees and flowers and a lot of crops that grow. It is very green, and even in the dry season, which was when I was there, it was full of growing vegetation. But what struck me most was, of course, its work. It is probably the only monastery in the world that has developed herbal medicine in a very professional way and is now well known throughout Nigeria. You can't help but notice that the long building, which as you drive into the monastery is very visible on the right-hand side, where people come from all over the local region for consultation with the consultants, some of them monks, to talk about their complaints, their anxieties, some to do with physical health, some to do with sexual health, some to do with their own emotional health, etc. And always they will meet up with a consultant who will see whether there is any herbal medicine which is appropriate to their condition.
At the heart of the centre is a man who believes that health is a state of harmony of mind and body.
Father Anselm Adodo is the manager, the director of this centre. And it brings together a lot of laymen and women from the region, because in this centre, not only do they treat people, but they also do the research on the roots and the leaves, particularly, of local plants, out of which they develop the various medicines that they produce. And there are now around about 50 of them. And it is becoming more and more widely known. They have a brand name called Pax Herbal. They have a website. But what is impressive is that all the development, the testing, the production, the packaging, it's all done in this one long building. And it becomes, therefore, quite a significant employer in that region. And as the medicines, herbal medicines, become more popular, so does the need for greater production, for more research, for more testing, for more relationship with ordinary medicine. And a dialogue continues with the various publications that they produce.
Abbot Timothy told me that Father Anselm has written books on the matter and is an enthusiastic supporter of the role of herbal medicine as a proper work for a monastic community.
And certainly, from my casual observation, and admittedly it was over a holiday period, there are a lot of people who come each day when the centre is open, and it produces for them a sense of well-being, because they got to find someone to talk to about their problems, to listen to them, and hopefully to be able to provide some form of remedy from among their various medicines. So this was an interesting element for me in a world where the growth of herbal medicine is something that is continuing fast. And it was interesting to see how it was integrated into the ordinary routines of the monastic life. Those who were involved in the herbal medicine also took a full part in the prayer life of the community, which starts pretty early in the morning, usually at about 4 o'clock with their office of matins, followed at 5 o'clock with Lourdes, and sometimes they have Mass in the morning, sometimes they have Mass in the evening. But it is a monastery in the sense that they keep the hours of the day, they sanctify each moment of the day, they give praise to God during their life of prayer. And the music they use is another element which I found very attractive. It's the using the instrument developed at another Benedictine monastery in Senegal called Kermusa, called the kora. A way of chanting the psalms, which sits nicely on into the African tradition, and I've now experienced in many monasteries in West Africa. And in its origin developed out of the plain song of the monks from Solem, who founded in the 1960s the monastery of Kermusa next door to Dakar in Senegal, from which developed the kora and its ways of chanting the psalms, of singing the propers and singing the hymns, which is not just traditionally African, but it's also, for a European, something which is new and lively, prayerful, and provides another insight in how monastic prayer operates. So my few days there were marked also by the fact that I was able to speak to the monks. They're facing an abbatial or prior election next year, for which I said I would be praying for them, and I spoke about my work with Islam. They were interested, asking good questions, and of course in Nigeria, where Muslim-Christian relations are not always as smooth and easy, it has a relevance for them. It was nice to meet the local emir and the local imam and to speak with him. His son works at the monastery in the herbal medicine enterprise, and the sense in which there is a mutual trust between the community and the local Muslim community was something that struck me. And there's a tolerance too, the tolerance of people converting one way or the other, and acceptance in a way that doesn't exist in other parts of Nigeria, and certainly not in other parts of the Muslim Christian world. The overall impression I had was of a monastery which is flourishing, with young monks coming in, young men as postulants, with a serious commitment to education and monastic formation, with a work which was relevant to the contemporary world and which would be financially rewarding for them to maintain the community. And for me, it was an inspiring experience and a lovely place to spend Christmas and the New Year.
And now it's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he talks about a film that you have probably already seen. It's apparently breaking all box office records and hurtling towards Oscar night with something like 9 nominations. Yes, you guessed. The film is Avatar, and I just had to ask Peter his personal opinion. Hello, Peter. Welcome back.
Thanks very much, Linda.
Nice to have you back on air again.
Thank you.
So, what are we starting with today?
I think we're starting with Avatar, aren't we?
I've been very resistant to this film, maybe because it's been billed as such a box office hit and everybody's going to see it. But the more I hear about it, the more my resistance is waning.
Well, it's been on top of the box office in the United States, I think, for 6 weeks. So a lot of people aren't resisting, and they're rushing along to see it.
I read a newspaper headline that says Avatar sinks Titanic, in the sense that Titanic apparently was the biggest box office hit in history, and it's now been surpassed by Avatar.
And James Cameron directed them both. So
right.
somebody remarked that quote that Leonardo DiCaprio said in Titanic, and Cameron said when he got the Oscar, "I'm king of the world." And they say, well, he definitely is in terms of movie box office.
So tell us about the film. Did you like it, first of all?
Well, actually, now that you use that phrase, first of all, I didn't at first. I found that the characters weren't particularly interesting, and the hero was a war veteran, a Marine, who was paraplegic and very limited in his personality and even in his repertoire of words.
I became a Marine for the hardship. I told myself I can pass any test a man can pass. All I ever wanted was a single thing worth fighting for.
So I thought, oh dear, I'm not going to enjoy this. And even Sigourney Weaver walking around, you know, with her cigarette and tough attitude, it didn't draw me in. But once the hero became an avatar and we went into the fantasy world, I was caught up in it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
And as everybody says, the technology is extraordinary, and I saw it in 3D, and that was most impressive.
You should see your faces.
The New Yorker describes it as the most physically beautiful American film in years. Would you agree?
Probably not. I'm sure there are many very beautiful films, but where this is distinctive, I think, is that you see the beauty in 3D. There's a sequence in the middle of the film where they go to these floating mountains. And I must say, I could have looked at those floating mountains for a long, long time, and then they get on these kind of prehistoric kind of bird animals and go flying around, and that was quite spectacular too, just irrespective of the plot, so to speak. So there were many wonderful things, and it is very beautiful at times.
Would you like to respond to the Osservatore Romano that called it simplistic, I think, and bland?
I was a bit surprised when I read that, and I read it at home in Australia, and papers were making a great deal of it, but the headlines were, you know, Vatican condemns Avatar. And I thought, well, that's journalistic sensationalism, because that's not what they were doing. But it created that impression, which I think is an unnecessarily bad impression of the church's attitude towards cinema and the media, that people run with even the slightest criticism as a condemnation. Not that we can't make criticism, of course, but I thought it was just one of those unfortunate things. As regards bland, I found that there were a lot of themes in it. In fact, an Australian journalist got very angry with it because it wasn't bland. He found it a very, what he called, left-wing agenda about American politics, about American foreign policy, about global warming, about the environment, even about women. So it did have all those themes dramatised in it, so that's not exactly the recipe for bland.
From what I read in the Osservatore Romano's critique was that it was saying that the film gets bogged down by a spiritualism that's linked to the worship of nature.
Well, yes and no. A lot of people who don't have faith in any religion, I'd be happy for them to have some kind of spiritual sense and a sense of the transcendent by an attention to nature. At least you can dialogue with people who have a spirituality rather than just a mere materialistic secularism. So it didn't bother me that there was a kind of, yes, pantheistic appreciation and almost worship of nature and a return to, well, some people might say New Age, but it's really old age appreciation of nature.
Well, as I was saying at the beginning, my resistance to the film is waning, and that's because I've seen, obviously, some of the images, and it does truly look quite visionary in its beauty.
Yes, I wish the story was stronger. Somebody then pointed out, and I've seen a document about Pocahontas, and that if you take out Pocahontas and put in the name of the alien female, it's virtually the same story. Which, well, it's a good story, so why not adapt it, of course? I would think that there's quite a deal in it, despite the basic story. And I think one of the drawbacks of a lot of Hollywood films, and I think this was true of Star Wars, sometimes a banal choice of words, vocabulary, not enough oomph in the writing. And that would have made it even more of a classic than it's going to be.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.